Well, it's lovely to be here on a beautiful day. What a wonderful day. Look, the subject we're going to be looking at is fairly complicated, and we don't have much time to do it. And look, you don't have to agree with everything I say or whatever. This is sometimes amongst Christians a fairly debatable point. According to modern scientific positions, the universe began about 13.8 thousand million years ago. It's a long, long time. At about 4.5 million years ago, the Earth was formed. At about 3.5 billion years ago, first life, very, very primitive life. Sponges didn't come into existence until 700 million years ago. Homo sapiens, modern man, until recently was thought to be about 200,000, but now it's put out to about 300,000 years ago. So according to scientific positions, generally accepted around the world in the scientific community, things are very, very, very old. and Homo sapiens, modern man, very, very old. 300,000 years is still pretty old, isn't it? Now, scientists make mistakes, they know about that. Well, they do the best they can, you hope. Sometimes they cheat, and that every now and again that gets found out. But basically, they try to work out what really is the truth of things in terms of time or what the world is really like and so on. I was part of that game, pretty small level. Nothing very exciting came out of the research that I did, but exciting for me that to be able to be involved in it. Scientific game is a complex thing, and they can be wrong, but my own position is that we're just discovering more and more about this universe and how complex it is, how huge it is. It's fascinating, you know, in the video when they were giving us the Big Bang thing, they were sort of giving you a picture, and it was there in a sort of a circular thing of things happening there and sort of energy sort of building up, and you were looking at it from the outside. Unfortunately, you can't do that. We're in the universe. To talk about looking at the universe from the outside doesn't actually make any sense. We're in it. We're caught up in it. And there isn't, as it were, from our point of view, a boundary out there. And yet talking about an expanding universe gives you the impression of, look, there's a boundary, you know, in space. No, sorry. Space is in the universe. And I know it's very, very complex. It's mysterious, isn't it? From a Christian perspective and from a Genesis perspective, God is on the outside. That's really pretty well the exception that we know about God and whatever of his own personal domain outside the universe. But for us, it's all inside the universe. Can't escape from it. Actually, there has been a scientific movement just recently to try and deal with the problem that this universe, however, is very exceptional. There are certain constants, you know, independent of units. I mean, you know, independent of things like kilometres or kilowatts or whatever. There are some actual constants in the universe that belong to the universe that the physicists, the mathematicians have worked out. That's pretty extraordinary. Another extraordinary thing is, as huge as the universe is, it's such a universe and expanded at such a rate that you can end up with what we call sentient, you know, thoughtful, reflective, very powerful in their thinking, beings like ourselves. It's expanded at such a rate and it has the constants to be what they are, such that there are beings like ourselves who can look at the universe and say, it's extraordinary, it's extraordinary. You only need the constants to be a certain sort of figure. You only need the expansion to be at a certain sort of rate for that ever to have happened from a, you know, evolving process, which we think has been going on all the time, physically and biologically, etc., etc. And in fact, it is so extraordinary that there's a move to say, oh, that can't be. Do you know why there's a move to say it can't be? Because it bespeaks of a creator. It says something special. You see, the universe is special. The universe is special. And the movement has been, amongst some, to say, well, we've got to get out of this conundrum. We can't have a creator. So, and this actually, the fellow who first of all came up with a very honest, in opposition to the notion that there has to be a creator, he decided, oh, the way out is easy. There's an infinite number of universes, and every now and again you're going to find one that's special. And so delivered him from the problem. There is still a difficulty, and people are trying to work on it. How do you communicate? How do you discover anything about other universes if universes are closed systems? And they have a genuine problem. I don't know how many people are involved in that, but the problem is the universe is so extraordinary, it does actually tend to suggest to you there's a creator. Well, now, what about Genesis chapters 1 and the first few verses of chapter 3? Look, I'm sorry to say this. Do you know what? We human beings are a bit ignorant. We do get things wrong. We don't understand a lot, and we keep on trying to get things correct, and I think we do a lot along that dimension, getting things better and better. See, one of the things that we've tended to forget, and sorry, there's my English gone on me. One of the things we've tended to forget is that Genesis chapter 1 and the Bible generally, but let's just focus on Genesis chapter 1, and if you like a little bit more of Genesis, it's a very, very ancient document. It was composed perhaps by Moses, certainly the bulk of the first five books of the Bible, that seems to be well the case, and maybe Genesis as well, put it together. Look, it's an ancient language to an ancient people who had different concepts that we have, had different concerns, different ways of thinking about things, different ways of picturing things. Picturing was very, very important that I think we've tended to forget in some of this ancient language. So we've got to be very, very careful when you look at it to try and not interpret it as though it was written in 21st century English or something or other, or Mandarin or whatever you like. We've got to be very, very cautious, and we didn't realise that until relatively recently. I mean, in the last 150 years, we began to be more and more aware that, goodness me, you've got to treat ancient literature from any culture as tricky, because we'll be looking at it with our 21st century eyes and ways of thinking. At least that's what happens today. Let me give you an illustration of this. In Judges, right at the beginning of Judges, the book of Judges, the writer says, basically, and the Israelites conquered all of Canaan. Now, a bit later on, he actually indicates that they didn't. You say, well, hang on, is he a bit ignorant? He wrote at one point that they did, and then he indicates that, no, we haven't been able to conquer that, Is he a bit foolish? Or does he didn't realise he told a lie? Look, that's nonsense. There is a prevailing way, which I think helps every now and again in a lot of parts of the Old Testament, of saying something in a very global manner to give you a certain impression, like we're on our way. See, that sort of an idea. So I'll just give you an illustration of how you've got to be very careful with language. The person who wrote Judges wasn't stupid. He knew what he was doing, but he was thinking and operating and writing differently than the way we would tend to do. Let's have a look at Genesis chapter 1 and a few verses. A number of things we could say about it. Oh, I'm told not to lean on that. My wife said, do not lean on the lectern. Gosh, I've done it again. Got to be like this. There we go. Look, one of the things about it is it's very carefully constructed. Very, very carefully constructed. Oh, like, before I forget it, you know, in that video we saw, the first video, it referred to God saying on each of the 6 days, and it was good, and it was good. Sorry, mistake. Second day, it's not recorded that God said it was good. And there's a good reason for it, by the way, if we get around to it. But it's just that every now and again we fall into traps. We think, oh, you know, I'll be smart and I've got it all worked out. Sorry. Genesis chapter 1 is very, very carefully constructed. When it says this here but doesn't say quite the same over here or quite the same there, the writer has in mind something. And sometimes it's a bit difficult for us to work out exactly, but I tell you what, the writer is very, very, very clever. Okay, let's look at a couple of other things. You notice it talks about the heavens and the earth. Right? God created the heavens and the earth. Why is the plural heavens there? Why not heaven and earth? I mean, Nehemiah speaks about God creating heaven and earth. Why heavens? Oh, and the name for God is Elohim. Look, I'm no Hebrew expert. I'm no expert in the English language, any language, as a matter of fact. But it's plural. What is this plurality going? And it's absolutely clear from the Bible. There is one God only. Why does he have a plural name? Why are you talking about the heavens? Look, this is just a guess on my part. It has to do with, I think, something like powerful, big, all-embracing. Let's give it plurality. It's that God is that huge. Give him a plural name. He's one God only, but he's Elohim. And the heavens are extraordinary. The heaven is extraordinary. Let's give it a plural name, the heavens. And of course they change, you see, during the night. Oh, the heavens, the heaven is extraordinary. Let's have a look at days 1, 2, 3 and days 4, 5 and 6. So on my right, on your left, I'm going to put what happens on day 1, day 2 and day 3. And over here, parallel to them, I'm going to put days 4 and days 5 and days 6. Just very briefly, what happens? Day 1, light. Day 4 over here, the lights. What happens on day 2? Well, it's the waters above and the water, the air above and the waters below. What happens here on day 5? The creatures who fly in the heavens, the birds and the great things and whatever that fish, the fish in the sea. See, there's a nice parallel. And on each of those four occasions, God said, let there be once. Let there be once. Let there be once. Let there be once. Now let's get day 3. On day 3, God says, let the waters depart and the land appear. Hang on. Looks like the land was already there. Oh, we might get back to that. Okay, so on day 3, what happens is you get the land and you get the plants and the fruit trees and so on lit on the land. You get God saying, let there be twice. Over on day 6, what you've got is God saying, let animals appear and let mankind come. And God says, let there be twice. What do? They live on the land and they eat the plants. The picture, in fact, that you're given from days 1, 2, 3 and 4, 5, 6 is that, goodness me, human beings, it's really all in the end for them. And they're created, all very powerful, they're created in the image of God. But by the way, just see the parallelism? See, nicely constructed, easy to remember, and it gives you a really full picture of what's going on, what the world is like. Now, there's a bit of a recent debate going on. Stop that. There's a bit of a recent debate going on, which is that... what is really being created? Is it material stuff and or is it order and roles to be played and functions to be performed? There's a bit of a debate going on. Now, we've tended to assume it all had to do with material. See? God just does this. God does that. He makes stuff. He makes stuff, 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 and so on. And they have a part to play. Well, let's look very carefully at the beginning of Genesis chapter 1. See, what the writer is saying is a little sort of a comma comes in there, as it were, in the Hebrew. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, comma. The situation being, that's the way the Hebrew reads, the situation being the earth was without form and void. It doesn't have any order to it, doesn't have any structure to it, and it's dark and it's watery. So you see, in a sense, Genesis chapter 1 is not saying, well, there's absolutely nothing, and then God makes things. From an ancient reader and writer's point of view, it's as good as nothing, and it's really thought of as nothing. What have you got? Nothing. You've got darkness and water and everywhere, and that's it. I mean, what's the... You know, there's nothing there, see? We would say, oh, but hang on, there is something. No, the ancient writer would say, you're not thinking like us, if he or she could talk to us today. No, it's basically nothing. It's ex nihilo. That's a sort of a way of people speaking about it, as though it's from nothing, but not the way that we think about nothing. And what does God do with the nothing? Well, you get this little sort of a lead-in. The Spirit of God is hovering over the waters. It's sort of like activity. Activity is just about going to be. Things are just about to happen. Okay? And so what God does was he deals with the darkness. And he says, and by the way, this is the majesty of God. Let there be. Now, very rarely in the ancient, so I understand it, very, very rarely in that ancient world, in that ancient world in which these texts arise, is there any sort of notion of a God saying or a God, you know, let there be. But there is one. There is actually one that I've come across just the other day. But it's very, very rare. What happens is that you've got a God or gods and they start fighting. They fight the beasts. They try to control the beast that might be there, the beast of chaos, the beast of nothingness. And they work on it and they control it. And finally, got you under control. And another god comes along, comes into being. And then after a while, of course, there are a lot of fighting going on between the gods and all sorts of things happen. But here you have in Genesis chapter 1, there being one God only. And he just says, there's no fight. There's no effort. It comes out of command. And by the way, look at how he uses the word or the phrase is, he names them. He gives a name to them. He's giving them a function. He's giving them a role. He's giving them a place to be. But he's the one who's giving it to them. And later on you read when the animals are brought to the man, translated Adam, but it's the man at that point in time in the scriptures, he names. He has some sort of role for them. He has a function for them to play. And he's the one who gives them the name. But here in Genesis chapter 1, it's God who gives names. And what is the first thing he does? He deals with the darkness. Let there be light. He doesn't name it as light. He names the light day, and he names the night the darkness night. And by the way, this is not picked up easily. After each of the 6 days, it says, and so there was evening comes first. There was evening and day. The sixth day, or the fifth day, or the fourth day, or the third day. What? See, easily forgotten. But that's why Jewish people, it's certainly, I don't know about today, but Jewish people, maybe in their religious observances, Jewish people in the time of Jesus, a day began when night fell. That's when days began. We say, oh, no, hang on, days begin, you know, in the morning. No, they don't. They begin when night falls, and then so you have all of night. And maybe it's a sort of a leftover of, it was all, from their point of view, darkness, you see. And then God gives order to it, and there's day, and this is going to be important because it's going to be, in the end, the sun and the moon, and they're going to be there for seasons. So you'll have times in which you can say, oh, this is the appropriate time of the year where we do this for God, for when you're going to sow your crops. So it's going to actually create a position where you can orderly control the universe, your world, as it were, whatever that might be. Wow. And this is all God's world. Fit for human beings. Made in the image of God. Now let's have a think about that. What is being made in the image of God according to the context of the text? I think it's a number of things. This is the one God, without effort, let there be, and naming, giving authority and control. And he says to these beings, male and female, created in our image. By the way, there's the plural again, by the way. And I think it's just, I don't think it's to do with the angelic court of God. Some people believe that's the case. I think it's just a way of God expressing himself. He is that big. He's plural, right? Anyway, I'm losing the track of what I was talking about. Doesn't matter. I'll come back to me. What on earth was I talking about just before I did that? You weren't listening. Oh, the evening and day. We did that thing. I know, the image of God. No, we're working on the image of God. See, I think what is being said here is that you are being placed, human beings are being placed in a position where they run the world. They are the controllers, see? The animals are brought to the man, and he names them, Genesis chapter 2. I think it means that, in a sense, you are God's representative. It might mean that as well. You are God's representative here in the world. You're going to be the source of knowledge. You're going to be not only the ones who control the world, but you're ones who are going to understand the world, as I understand. I'm giving you a position, mankind, of privilege. By the way, with that letter from Kanishka about lack of freedom, it just shows you how people are cramping down upon. We don't want to know. We don't want to know. We don't want to know about God. We don't want to know about what God might say or think and how we should live. He knows best. But no, we're not thinking about he knows best. We're thinking about what I would like to do and what I want the freedom to do, but that means I've got to shut you down and I'll be free to do this and that and the other thing. Look, I'm going to close with this. Sorry if I've gone on too long. Modern science and technology is pretty modern. It didn't really get going until about the 15th, 16th century. Why did it take such a long time to do? I mean, our knowledge has expanded enormously compared to the ancient world, enormously. And it really got going only about, 500, 600 years ago. Now, historians work on this. I'm no historian, but historians have worked on this, and there appear to be a number of reasons. One is our knowledge of the way that the Greeks, the intellectual Greeks, operated was reborn. We became aware of it. We'd lost it, but became... And what the Greeks are well known for is, that is, the philosophers, they were thinkers. They would reflect. And in order for the modern science and technology to get going, you need reflectors. I mean, in the sense of thinkers. Right? Another one, a mathematician of some stature, in my eyes, unfortunately he's died, he actually confirmed this for me. Apparently, the invention of the symbol and the concept of zero came late, but extremely important mathematically, apparently, and the decimal system, much better than the old system of sixes, thinking in terms of tens, much, much easier to people to make calculations. So there's important things. Look, I'm quoting other people here. You also needed a view somewhat like, if not almost exactly like, what the Jewish and Christian and even Muslim people had in mind about the nature of God. That's what you needed. You needed to have a view that said, look, it doesn't matter where I look in the world, it's going to be the same, because my understanding is that God is in control of the whole universe and there's only one of them. There aren't competing gods. And if this is true, if God runs there's only one, he's not competing with anybody, and he's an ordered God, Genesis chapter 1, order and function and role, then it may be possible, you see, to start thinking and using our mathematical skills to work on what is the world really like, anywhere in the world, anywhere in the universe. I can work on it and it might make sense. And it took off. And stuff that I was engaged on had to make sense. I remember working with some people in the United States on one occasion saying to them, look, there's a particular school of thought who thinks this way, and there's a particular school of thought who thinks that way about the same thing. Two schools of thought. I said to this fellow, who do you think is going to win? Now, he somewhat cunningly said, and there's some truth in it probably, he said, the one with has the most postgraduate students. That's the one, and the most money that comes in terms of research. And look, sometimes that happens. But in the end, it has to be your claim and your defence for and your evidence for what you think is true. And you cannot work on that if, in fact, you do not have a view that the universe is a wholesome thing. It is a one thing. If it was not for the Judeo-Christian perspective, it is arguable modern science and technology would never have arisen. My view is, thanks be to God. Now, look, we've gone a bit late, but is there a time for some couple of questions or not?
Yes.
Okay, and disagreements and whatever. Yes, you've got to speak up pretty loudly for me.
Okay, when you say God is multiple, could that be referring to the Trinity? Because Jesus...
Sorry, I'm not hearing.
Sorry, God as multiple, couldn't it be the Trinity, Jesus and the Holy Spirit?
The fact that God is in plural, couldn't that be Trinity? Look, that is what some people would...
Yeah,
I'll repeat the question. The fact that God is spoken of in plural and that he says, let us make mankind in our image, couldn't that be a reference to the Trinity? That is, that God is actually somehow or other speaking to the Holy Spirit and speaking to the Son. You can argue that way, and that certainly is a possibility. I just think in the context, it's not. I for years ago would have thought it was more like God speaking to his heavenly cohort, and that because they were able to relate to God, the angelic world, and so on. I'm not going any more into that. We've got enough on our plate right now. And I would have thought that. However, I just think it has to do with the bigness of God and the plurality of his name, Elohim. That's just my view. You're entitled to a different point of view. Got the other? Yes, come on.
If the Christian perspective helped science to be born,
yes,
where in our history did science then want to start throwing God out of the picture?
Look, the question is, if actually the Judeo-Christian point of view really is one of the prime reasons why science and technology took off, what does that...
When did it
change? Oh. How did it happen that science is now basically trying to sort of turn its back on God? Yeah, very interesting question, a very important question. Look, in the United States, they carried out... Now, over 100 years span, they carried out a questionnaire on scientists as to their beliefs in a deity, not necessarily in the God of Christianity, but in a deity. And what has happened over that 100 years is there's been, amongst the scientific community, less and less confidence that there is a God. They could look at the evidence in terms of whether you were, this is, you know, a fairly neat, easy classification, doesn't always fit, in terms of whether you were a physicist or a chemist or a geologist or a biologist, right? The people who had the least confidence that there was a deity were the biologists. The ones that had the most confidence that there was a deity were the physicists. And amongst those, it would appear to be the cosmologists, the ones who actually work on the nature of the universe. Now, that percentage has been dropping over that 100 years, but that order seems to be the case. What happened, I think, was, from the biological point of view, was that when Darwin, not necessarily a Christian at all, but when Darwin came up with the theory of evolution and so on, or when it began to get some evidence for it, and I think the evidence, by the way, is fairly powerful myself. For instance, just one little thing on the side. Why would it be on Madagascar? There were some species, the only near relatives you could find for them would be on mainland Africa. But they're not related, like they're quite interdependent. But the only close connections you've got between one and the other is when they're not too far apart. And I mean, that's just suggestive of, over time, the one species developed into two sets of species. A number of species are involved. Anyway, I'm just throwing that in. See, I think what happened was, we Christians, because we didn't look at the scriptures carefully enough, because we couldn't, because we were caught in our own culture, we decided that's got to be anti-God. And so there began to be, particularly in the United States, a very anti-God disposition from the biological world. We attacked them, they attacked us. And today in the United States, and I've lived there for a year and a half all up, and you've got to be careful as to what you say to what person, as to how they're going to react. And we just need to be more thoughtful. Look, I tell you what, it doesn't matter who you are, whether you're a scientist or scientific sort of disposition, or whether you're a Christian and you love the Lord Jesus and you're really grateful that there's one God, there is no satisfactory substitute for the truth. We just got to be humble enough every now and again to say, gee, I might have got that wrong. It's hard for Christians to say it. It's hard for non-Christians to say it. But I tell you what, there is no satisfactory substitute for the truth, whatever that might be. Whatever that might be. And that means humility. Someone ourselves. Look, we should be finishing up, but just one more if that's possible. But thank you for it. It's an important question. It's easier to be a Christian in Australia than it is to be a Christian in some parts of the United States. Much easier. Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Sorry?
You sound like you're favourable towards evolution, as am I, because it fits within a certain understanding of Genesis 1.
Yep.
What about the evolution of man?
Yep. The evolution of man is... Yep. What about... The question was, probably everyone heard you, the evolution of man. I'm not a biologist, goodness me. It appears to be fairly complex. We in fact think that Neanderthal man and hominoids of another nature probably did intermarry, and that what you're not looking at is some sort of pure species that had no connection with Neanderthal man, for instance. I'm just saying, from my knowledge at the moment, it appears to be fairly complex. What is important, and we don't have time for it, is what are we going to do with chapters 2 and 3 that refers to begin with, the man. His name is not Adam, he's called the man. There's the word the. And she's not called Eve until he tells her. That's how he says, I'm naming you Eve. He basically has some sort of control over you, see, by giving her the name. Because of the fact that she's something to do with living, and that seems to be connected to the word Eve. But what are we going to do with that? Look, I'll just give you something that came out from a fellow called Walton, W-A-L-T-O-N. I think he's in the United States. I think he's a very powerful person in trying to come to terms with what's true. He's a Christian man, thoroughly Christian man. His own view is this. He says, I think there was a real Adam and Eve. Maybe about, 7,000 years ago. Adam and Eve wasn't their name. But because they're described in terms of their entity. He's a man, and she's Eve, who he ends up going with. Where did this take place? Well, probably somewhere near the Persian Gulf. It's interesting, in Genesis chapter 2, you've got a description of four rivers. And generally, people think about the four rivers sort of spanning out from a main river. I think we're actually reading it the wrong way. I think it's actually got to go upwards. And when you go upwards, you get the four rivers from the Garden of Eden. You have four rivers. One is the Euphrates, one is Tigris. Now, the next thing is it gives you the name of the next two, and it actually describes some things about them. And you say, but, gee, we don't know about them today. Look, aerial photography has picked out a third river system, which has since dried up. I think what you've got is a very ancient writing about a very ancient setting where God decided... Now is the time I will intervene in my creation in a way that I've not intervened before. And this is just Walton, and I think there's a lot to suggest it's reasonable. That about 5,000 years BC, God steps in and he actually does work with a human being and another human being, and they fail the test. And so begins the whole business of morality, righteousness, understanding who you are, understanding who God is. And God over time reveals more and more of himself, and we understand. And you say, well, goodness me, why would God take such a long time before he finally steps in? Oh, we're the stupid ones. See, God's outside the universe. Time, haven't got a clue what it means to God outside the universe. He operates within the universe with time with us. But what it's like for God, we have no idea whatsoever. But let's have a look very quickly at the Garden of Eden. Two interesting trees. Tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. What does it really mean to have a tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Very peculiar tree, isn't it? And what about this tree of life? Very peculiar tree. Do they not stand, as it were, using an ancient cultural way of looking at things for... something going on about mankind under test, and mankind fails. By the way, notice that the reason why they are expelled from the garden is because we must not allow them to touch, to take of the tree of life. We cannot have such creatures living forever. Now, is it perhaps we think of it too much in 21st century, you know, ways of concepts and so on. My own thinking is just, you may have to explore it in your own thinking, is that we're not looking at things black and white, but we're giving pictures. We're being given pictures of things. And the pictures are meant to be there to tell us the truth. See, what does a tree of life mean? I mean, can you imagine a tree of life? What does a tree of knowledge of good and evil mean? And if you eat it, look, the story of Adam and Eve is something we can't go into because we've run out of time. But I think it might be, indeed, that God decided to intervene into, and this may be partly behind your question, that God decided to intervene in the world in a way that we now understand things, maybe only about 7,000 years ago. But you may want to disagree with that entirely. That's understandable, and that's maybe, and that's fair enough. Did that make any sense, what I was talking about then? I think it really is the case that we've lost the art of painting pictures, and that God wants to paint pictures of the truth for our own sake. Why don't I just finish in prayer? Heavenly Father, before you know how ignorant we are, and you know how stubborn we can be just changing our minds. Please have mercy on us. Please help us to understand where we get things wrong. Help us to understand and have more confidence where we get things right. Make us a blessing to other people, our families. Help us to help them to see your reality. Help them in the end to have confidence in your Son and in your raising him from the dead. Please have mercy on them. Amen. The resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. In the end, whatever your doubts or difficulties, have a little focus on that. What is the evidence for the raising of Jesus from the dead? Powerful.